Expert HR Weekly, compliance, good practice and benchmarking for UK HR professionals.
Hello and welcome to Expert HR Weekly with me, Susan Dennehy. A recent employment tribunal case, Lockover and Spurbank CIB Limited and others, serves as a reminder that employers will be liable for the acts of discrimination, including harassment, carried out by their employees at work. With me to discuss what constitutes sexual harassment in the workplace and discuss typical situations that employers may face, including at work-related events, is Principal Employment Law Editor Stephen Simpson. Welcome to Expert HR Weekly, Stephen.
I see.
Can we start with a reminder of the legal definition of sexual harassment?
Sure. So the law is contained in the Equality Act 2010, which, to paraphrase slightly, says that harassment occurs where a person A engages in unwanted conduct related to the protected characteristic of sex, or engages in unwanted conduct of a sexual nature that has a purpose or effect of violating person B's dignity or creating an intimidating, hostile, degrading, humiliating or offensive environment for him or her, or also less favourable treatment because of a person's rejection of or submission to sex-related harassment or harassment of a sexual nature.
Not the easiest definition to remember, it's quite technical. Could you break it down for us a bit?
Yeah, sure. So in effect, there are three types of harassment that are prohibited. Firstly, unwanted conduct of a sexual nature perpetrated on a particular person, which is what most people will think of as sexual harassment, so covering things like unwelcome sexual advances. Secondly, there sex-related harassment, which means unwanted conduct related to the protected characteristic of sex. And the important thing there is that the unwanted conduct does not have to be directed towards the complainant or related to their actual sex. And then thirdly, there's less favourable treatment based on a person's rejection of or submission to sex-related harassment or sexual harassment. So the classic example there would be the woman who's rejected for promotion by her boss after turning down his sexual advances. So she could have a claim under this provision if she believes that she would have got promotion if she had accepted his sexual advances.
The law takes account of all kinds of behaviour, doesn't it? Not just the ones we commonly think of, not just inappropriate comments or gestures.
Yes, the HRC statutory guidance gives many examples, including, just to read briefly from the guidance, spoken or written words of abuse, imagery, graffiti, physical gestures, jokes, pranks, acts affecting a person's surroundings or other physical behaviour.
And there were some interesting examples from the case that we mentioned earlier, Lockover, such things as she was called Miss Cokehead, Madame, she had unfortunate natural brain chemistry, and Miss Bonkers. So those sort of comments. And what are the most common types of sexual harassment?
This is purely my impression from all the tribunal cases we monitor, but the most common seem to relate firstly to comments of a sexual nature or inappropriate jokes, for example, of a sexist nature, and secondly to unwanted physical contact.
But sex discrimination laws have been in for a long time. Are there any types of sexual harassment that you don't see so much of anymore?
Well, I'd say a lot of the key cases in the 80s and early 90s revolved around posters and pin-ups, pictures of topless models pinned up in the workplace, that sort of thing. So thankfully, you don't really see those sorts of complaints so much anymore. But that's probably mainly due to technology. You're much more likely these days to see cases in which one colleague is alleged to have harassed another online, for example, on Twitter or Facebook, or, say, emailed round to colleagues an offensive joke or image.
Have you got any example of the more unusual type of conduct?
So we really don't have to go very far back. We reported a case in February called Rosinski and Q Medical Technologies, in which the claimant witnessed her line manager at a sales conference and another man reenact to a crowd a sexually suggestive scene from the film Ghost as a forfeit in an after-dinner game. The incident included her line manager taking off his belt and undoing his top trouser button before immediately fastening it up again.
And was that found by the tribunal to be sexual harassment?
In that instance, no, mainly because of the context. It was just a single incident, not intended to offend anyone, and was done in fun at a party at which no one else saw anything untoward. The tribunal pointed out that simply considering a colleague's actions to be unprofessional isn't by itself sufficient to make those actions harassment. So in other words, seeing someone you work with acting like an idiot isn't always sufficient by itself to be harassment, even if there is a sexual element to their behaviour.
The employee's perception that she considered that the behaviour amounted to sexual harassment clearly wasn't enough in that situation, so it's not only the employee's perspective. What's the position if, as with this allegation, the incident takes place at a work-related event? Can you tell us the consequences of that?
Yeah, sure. So employers can still be held liable for sexual harassment even if the event is held off-site and out of normal working hours. Typically, it's something like the Christmas party or, as in this case, an event away from the normal workplace, such as a sales conference. Employers will have a defence to a claim of sexual harassment if the to ensure that it took all reasonable steps to prevent the employee from performing the act. The first step is to establish this defence is obviously to make sure that employees are aware of your policy on harassment. So that might take the form of communication in advance of the event, warning employees of their responsibility to behave at the party, whatever event it is.
And you raised a very important point there, the possibility of a defence. Are there any other reasons to look at this case?
Yes, because the claimant made a number of complaints of sexual harassment, some of which were upheld and some of which were rejected. It's a really good example of how difficult it can be to draw the line between what's harassment and what's simply unprofessional behaviour. And most of the incidents in this case could easily have been found to be harassment on another day if heard by a more unforgiving tribunal judge. It's also a good example of how a series of less serious incidents can combine to lead to a breakdown in the employment relationship.
And can you tell us, Stephen, which of those incidents were actually found to be harassment?
There were two incidents that were found to be sexual harassment. In the first, the line manager made suggestive remarks about enjoying watching the claimant and another female colleague pin conference name badges to their shirts on the breast area. In the second, a conversation about how to win a potential customer ended up with her manager advising her to wear a short skirt and low-cut top when she went to see the prospect. So both of those were clearly sexual remarks that degraded the claimant.
And did it make any difference that the perpetrator in that case was her manager?
Yes, I think so. Tribunals are very mindful that the manager will be in a position of power, and something that a peer might get away with might be looked at more harshly if done by the claimant's line manager.
And do the cases mostly revolve around a manager harassing an employee?
Yes, often they do, but not always. It's also often employees at the same level, and it's even possible for subordinates to harass a manager. So, for example, we reported a case in 2011 against the Royal Mail in which male employees in a sorting office ganged up on their new female manager.
That's quite unusual. Is that a common problem, would you say, Stephen, for employers?
I think it can sometimes happen for employers that operate in male-dominated environments where you see a group of male employees who are not used to being managed by a woman challenging the authority of a female manager. That Royal Mail case contains some of the worst paper I've read about in a case, including threats to the claimant.
I mean, you mentioned earlier it's not always a man harassing a woman.
Yeah, there have actually been cases of a man sexually harassing another man and even a woman harassing a man.
And can you give us an example?
A good example there is Basil and Royal College of General Practitioners. And in that case, a man was found to have sexually harassed another man with sexual comments and gestures, not all of which were directed at the claimant. These included a greeting of "How's it hanging?" and making rude sexual hand gestures.
And what about a man accusing a woman of harassment? Have you got any examples of those sorts of cases?
This is pretty rare in case law, but it has happened. In a 1994 case, Picarillo and Star Service Stations, a petrol station worker who was embarrassed by his female manager using the F word, brought a sexual harassment claim.
And was his claim successful?
No, it was actually dismissed. The tribunal said that the claimant was a man of unusually delicate sensibilities and he was clearly simply being oversensitive.
But what about a woman? Can she, in theory, commit misconduct by harassing a man?
I think so, yes. In contrast to the previous case, in an anonymised case called X and Y, the Employment Tribunal found that a woman was fairly treated when she was dismissed for aggressive sexual behaviour, including flashing of breasts towards a considerably younger male colleague with a slighter physical build than her.
OK, that case was about misconduct, but in theory, I think it's fair to say, is that a woman can harass a man. Does it matter if the alleged perpetrator's motives are benign?
No, the important element is if on the claimant, even if there's no discriminatory purpose behind the actions.
And have you got any examples from the case law of that?
I'd say the one that springs to mind is a 2010 case called Craddock and Fontura, another case with some pretty strange facts. In this case, the owner of a small business unwisely attempted to play matchmaker. The tribunal memorably described it as him playing Cupid between a male and a female employee. He suggested repeatedly to the male employee that he should go out on a date with the female employee, despite the fact that she already had a boyfriend.
Well, you said it was a strange case, and who brought the sexual harassment claim in that case?
Interesting, it was the male employee who claimed harassment, saying that he was extremely embarrassed by the situation, and he was actually eventually awarded £4,500 for sexual harassment. It didn't matter to the tribunal that the motive of the harasser was innocent. The key issue will be the effect on the person who is on the receiving end of the behaviour.
And what if the employee appears to accept to join in with the conduct, which you quite commonly see? What's the position there?
That's an interesting area, and it won't necessarily allow a sexual harassment claim to be defended. Tribunals will take into account that it's really normal human reaction to be embarrassed by inappropriate behaviour, and and not want to be seen to be causing trouble by making a complaint, especially if the person is in a position of power and they're doing the harassing, sometimes even the owner of a business if it's a smaller company.
And have you got any cases that you can think of that you can give us by way of an example?
The key case is the EAT decision in Munchkin's Restaurant and Karmazin and others, in which four waitresses put up with conduct of a sexual nature from the restaurant's owner over a significant period of time, years in some cases, in fact, even initiating talk of a sexual nature themselves as a method of coping with and diffusing the owner's behaviour.
And was that enough to defeat their sexual harassment claim?
No, they still actually won their case and the EAT upheld the tribunal ruling. The EAT agreed with the tribunal's reasoning that the reason they didn't actually complain and didn't leave their employment was that they had financial constraints and had no certainty of obtaining work elsewhere.
And what's the position if the harassed employee is reluctant to come forward and make a complaint?
I think this is a really difficult situation, but I'd say the employer still has to act in some way. It should investigate the allegations, even if made by a third party, such as a colleague, who perhaps witnessed the incident, and take appropriate disciplinary action.
Have you any examples from the case law of this happening?
Yes, so we've just reported a case in which a worker on a 0 hours contract was reluctant to raise a grievance against her manager for alleged serious sexual harassment. She clearly felt that she would be at risk of her manager reducing her hours since he controlled how much work she was given. It's worth noting that the claimant in this case was a particularly vulnerable person. Not only was she on a 0 hours contract, but she was aged just 22 at the time and had a history of mental health problems.
But she did eventually complain, didn't she?
Yes, she did speak to a manager, but asked the manager not to formalise the issue. But the issue eventually did come out at a meeting about another incident.
And she brought a tribunal claim for sexual harassment.
Yes, and she was awarded quite a large sum. She got £19,500 after the tribunal slated her employer's approach to the investigation, including pointing out delays caused by the investigation being restarted several times, the cursory investigatory meetings against the parties involved, and various managers' inactivity once they knew about the issues.
Are there any lessons for employers from this case?
What I'd say is really I'd urge employers to read this case as an example of how not to handle a harassment complaint, and it's an example of what many people see as the inherent unfairness of 0 hours contracts, which of course is a very topical issue at the moment.
Indeed. Thank you very much for that very useful guidance, Stephen, on sexual harassment and the problems that employers can face. That's it from us. You've been listening to Expert HR Weekly with me, Susan Dennehy, and Stephen Simpson. Thanks again, Stephen. We're back again next Friday. In the meantime, it's goodbye from us.
Expert HR Weekly, the latest from experthr.co.uk, the award-winning subscription service for HR professionals.